Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Western states are preparing for yet another drought. Last week, Utah Governor Spencer Cox declared an official drought and urged residents to conserve. Here in California, more than a third of the state is in an extreme or exceptional drought, according to data from the U.S. Drought Monitor. And unfortunately, we are not getting much water from the mountains. Snow water content across the Sierras is running at 60 to 75% of average. According to the Sacramento Bee, the Sierra Nevada snowpack, whose spring melt is ordinarily crucial to replenishing the state's major rivers and reservoirs, is 37% thinner than normal for this time of year. Shasta Lake, the state's largest reservoir, is one-third emptier than usual for this date, while Lake Oroville is about half as full as it should be. Last week, the State Water Resources Control Board mailed early warning notices to 40,000 farmers, municipal officials, and others, telling them that they need to prepare for potential shortages. So the big question is California prepared this time around? What have we learned since the last five-year drought, which cost the state billions of dollars? Joining us is Dr. Jay Lund, director of the Center for Watershed Sciences and professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Davis. Hi, Professor Lund. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, Professor Lund, over the weekend, I heard so many people say that they were so happy to feel sunshine after a very cold winter. But we just didn't get enough rain. So how concerned are you? I mean, when you look at the numbers, I mentioned a few. I'm looking at San Francisco, for example. Precipitation between July and March was just at 38% of normal. So how concerned are you?
Very concerned. I think last year was also a dry year. And this year has been a little bit drier even than last year. So the reservoir levels in much of the state are well below average, and some of the larger reservoirs are at about 50 or 60% of average for this time of year.
And also The Guardian had a piece about this. Northern California is stuck in one of the worst two-year rainfall deficits seen since 1849.
Yes, it's very dry. Yeah. Normally we don't see this amount of dryness for a little bit longer drought, maybe a third or fourth year of a drought. But we're seeing this in the second year of a drought. The elevation of Shasta Reservoir is down at about where it was at the third or fourth year of the previous drought.
So what are you hearing from state officials? Politico had an interesting story about, well, the headline says it all. California's drought is back, but nobody wants to hear it from Newsom. Because of what's happening with COVID, because of this recall effort, which we're going to do a show about in a couple of weeks. What are your thoughts about how Governor Newsom is dealing with this? And what else are you hearing from state officials?
Well, most of the water management in the state is actually done at the local level by your local water district, your local city or town, local irrigation districts. And so they're really at the front line of managing for drought. And they have a lot of preparation that they've been making for decades and since the last drought in preparation for the next drought, which is now.
So talk about the lessons. You told The Guardian that the lessons from the period of 2012 to 2016 was that the first year of dryness is not so bad for most of California, and that cities and agriculture can withstand maybe one or two parched years without too much trouble. But if we get a third or fourth dry year in a row, that is when we start to see very big problems and big economic impacts.
That's true. California is different than most of the rest of the United States in having a long, dry summer. I'm from back east, and I like to tell people that California every year has a worse drought than most of the United States, the eastern part of the United States, has ever seen in historical times. So the economy, the agriculture, the water systems in California are built around surviving a single dry year. When we get to a second dry year, many of the systems are able to cope with that because of stored water or groundwater or things like that. But when we start to get to third and fourth years or longer for droughts, then the problems really start to accumulate.
We've spent so much time, Professor Lund, talking about needed changes in California. What would you say has changed since the last drought, the last couple of years that we've been talking about?
Well, we've seen on the urban side a little bit more emphasis on urban water conservation. So per capita water use has been decreasing in California for a very long time, and particularly since the last drought. So that reduces our drought vulnerability by a bit and preserves water for longer droughts. Agriculture has still has a problem in that when they face a drought, the biggest thing that they do is they pump additional groundwater. Mm-hmm. In 2014, during the previous drought, realizing that this was a problem for the long term with long-term groundwater overdraft, the state passed groundwater regulations for the first time so that by the year 2040, we're not supposed to be overdrafting aquifers in California anymore. But it takes a long time to get there. Some parts of California, some agricultural areas of California rely on groundwater overdraft for up to about 30-35% of their water use. So this is going to be very painful over time, and having a drought now is not going to make it any easier.
Well, if you have any questions or comments about the drought, Professor Lund is going to stay with us for about 10 more minutes. So now would be a good time to call 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Professor Lund, because agriculture is so crucial to this state, let's spend a little bit of time talking about this. Politico reports that last week, state and federal water officials cut the projected amount of water they plan to send farmers and cities. And the Sacramento Bee has a piece about this. They quote Joe Del Bosque, a prominent farmer on the parched west side of the San Joaquin Valley, who got some very grim news last week from the San Luis Water District. They said, "We're facing another 2014-2015 when we had zero water supply." He relies on the federal government Central Valley Project to deliver the water for the cantaloupes, the other crops that he grows on 2,000 acres. So let's talk more about this, because researchers at your university at UC Davis found that hundreds of thousands of acres of land went fallow during the drought. We've had you on talking about this, erasing billions of farm income, and farm workers saw their livelihoods suffer. So what do you expect this time around?
I think we're going to see this again. We're going to see farmers like this gentleman having to pump groundwater or to buy water from neighbors or other parts of the state in order to provide minimal amounts of water to keep their crops and their businesses going. You'll see some layoffs of farm workers in some parts of the state. You'll see the need for counties and the state government to sort of pitch in and try to help these farm workers and these businesses to keep going. Some of this will be part of a longer term adjustment on the need to reduce groundwater use. So over time, not all of these acres of agriculture are going to come back. Some of them will need to be fallowed in the long term. We estimate that between 500,000 and 1 million acres of irrigated land in the southern part of the Central Valley will have to be fallowed over the long term in order to bring groundwater basins back into balance, which is the major source of stored water for droughts.
What are your thoughts, Professor Lund, about the conversation around water-intense crops and what should be fallowed? I mean, we're talking about major livelihoods here, families' livelihoods. But a lot of people say, for example, we just can't keep growing certain things that require so much water. What are your thoughts just around how that conversation has changed over time now that we have so much information?
Well, I tend to think that most of those conversations are barking up the wrong tree. What I think we really should be most interested in is maintaining the vitality of the rural economy as much as possible. And that requires that we grow crops that bring money into the rural economy. There's not a lot of difference between the water use of different crops, the consumptive water use of different crops, the evaporative use of water for different crops. And so overall, you want to have the most crops, most jobs per drop, which correlates fairly well with the amount of revenues that come in per drop of water.
And then let's spend a little bit of time talking about groundwater, because this is so, so crucial, and there's going to be major changes, and this is very controversial also among farmers. According to the Sacramento Bee, during the drought, Valley farmers pumped the equivalent of 7 Shasta Lakes worth of groundwater to irrigate crops. Community wells went dry, forcing some poor towns to import bottled water, and areas for the valley floor crumbled because of the excessive pumping. And so we've talked about former Governor Jerry Brown signing a law to restrict groundwater pumping, and the law requires newly formed regional groundwater agencies to restore supplies to 2015 levels by the year 2040. This is a very difficult task, Professor Lund. What are your thoughts on this? What are you hearing from all of the players involved?
Well, I'd agree with you. It's going to be a very difficult task. Like I said, it's going to require the fallowing of about between 500,000 and 1 million acres of irrigated agriculture in the southern parts of the Central Valley. That by itself is an immense economic impact for those local areas. However, if we do this, there are better ways to do this, in the sense of you want to make sure that you're fallowing the least productive land that perhaps also has the biggest problems with salinity accumulations as well. So I think if you have the right kinds of water markets and allocations of that water, remaining water, among the agricultural economy in that area, you can just about have the total economic impact of that pretty large reduction in irrigated agriculture.
Well, today we are talking about the drought that is upon us. It's happening. Utah just declared an official drought last week. And then data from the U.S. Drought Monitor reveals that over 90% of California is suffering through a moderate drought or worse. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of help coming from the mountains. We just did not get the rain that we needed this time around. Professor Lund has to leave us in about 5 minutes. So let's go to a few questions. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good morning, Rose. Good morning, Dr. Lund. Not to put salt on wounds, but how has the federal land management of water been, and what are the ramifications for fire season, which seems to have gotten longer and longer?
Wildfires are probably the biggest impact of drought. Certainly that was the case with the previous drought, and it's likely to be the case with this drought as well. One of the really interesting and difficult aspects of wildfires that are made worse by droughts is that a lot of those impacts occur after the drought has actually ended, after it started to rain again, because you have a lot of dead trees up in the forest. Fortunately, the only good thing I can say about wildfires and drought is that the lack of water in the reservoirs and the like usually has very little to do with the ability to fight fires. The problems with wildfires and drought have to do with there just wasn't enough rain and snow up in the watershed, and there's very little that we can do to go back up today during a drought and make those problems go away or reduce those problems. We just sort of have to learn how to adapt to them and perhaps better manage the forests over the long haul to reduce the likelihood of wildfires from drought.
And Professor
Lund, that's a very long-term proposition.
In a recent blog post, you wrote that in the long term, California's forests might look different. It might be an ecosystem with fewer trees, closer to what the environment looked like in the early 1800s before widespread European settlement.
There are quite a few researchers that seem to indicate that. And I think over time, there's even some thought that reduced density of trees will also increase by a little bit the amount of runoff that we get from the forests up in the mountains.
Well, thank you for the call, Bill. We have an email from Alan who says, thank you for this topic. What can the average listener do to track the drought beyond measuring precipitation at the local park watershed or ridges?
There's a wonderful website that the California Department of Water Resources has called the California Data Exchange Center. They have lots of wonderful depictions of precipitation, snowpack, reservoir levels all over the state.
All right, the California Data Exchange Center. We will find that and put a link on our website right after the show. Thank you for the question, Alan. We have another question from SR who says, why is there no dialogue about incentives to improve soil quality to better sequester water?
Soils are really important for sequestering water, but normally they can only hold water for a few months. And so when you have a very long dry season like California has, you can only retain some of the water from the wet season, which we don't have much of this year, a few months into the dry season. And that's actually what starts the fire season, when that soil moisture starts to become depleted.
Well, thank you, SR. A really important topic. We've been wanting to do a show about soil, so I'm glad you wrote in to remind us of that. Let's go to another caller, Nick in Oakland. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Question for the professor. As you know, the Santa Barbara County aquifers are extremely low. The rainfall there is almost non-existent. And they just got done approving hemp for commercial growing in the county, which is going to dramatically increase the water demand for that area and possibly consume all the aquifer water in the aquifers. Just wondering if the professor is aware of this. Thanks.
Yeah, there are several parts of California that have large aquifer management problems, and I think that's one of the reasons that has that. The Tulare Basin in the Bakersfield area is probably the biggest groundwater overdraft in the state, but certainly many of the coastal aquifers, such as in the Santa Barbara area, are also problematic as well.
Well, thank you for that question. Professor Lund, I know we have to let you go. We're getting so many emails. I mean, people are very, very concerned about this drought. Well, here we are. What is it? March 29th. We're almost into April. How bad do you think it's going to be this year?
It'll be about as bad as last year, but we're going into it with much lower levels of water in the reservoirs and an additional year of pumping that has happened last year because last year was dry. So we can expect to see many of these rural areas having problems with their household wells and small community wells going dry. Mm. And we should really be paying attention to the ability of Shasta and some of the other reservoirs to store cold water and make cold water available for salmon downstream.
Well, that is another very important issue that we'd love to do a show about, is the water needed for the salmon and other fish. Dr. Jay Lund is director of the Center for Watershed Sciences and professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Davis. Professor Lund, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. We have a number of really great articles at yourcallradio.org, and I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your questions. Professor Lund only had about 20 minutes to spend with us today, but we will definitely do another show about droughts very soon because this is such a serious, serious issue. And you can find those articles at yourcallradio.org. But now we are going to change gears and talk about a very important investigation that caught our attention in the Los Angeles Times. In October, reporter Rosanna Shaw published an investigative piece about how the waters off Catalina Island became a dumping ground for DDT waste from the 1940s to the 1980s. As many as 500,000 barrels had been dumped just off the coast of Los Angeles. And Rosanna Shaw writes, the fouling of the ocean was so reckless, some said it seemed unimaginable. Rosanna Shaw is an environment reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She covers the coast and has has written about sea level rise, toxic dumping, and endangered species in the deep ocean. Her stories have led to new laws and regulations, and she was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2020 for this important investigation. Hi, Rosanna. Thank you so much for joining us again. This was an amazing story.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, how did you first learn about the dumping of DDT?
Yeah, so it started with a phone call from a source, and maybe I should back up and just start with, I don't know about you, but I needed a primer on what DDT was because it had been banned in the 70s, and I feel like an entire generation has almost forgotten or moved on from this now kind of historic chemical. It's like something that you learn in one chapter of a history textbook or in Chem 101. So DDT was, you know, this pesticide that was super popular in the 50s, and it was what led to the destruction of the bald eagle populations and caused all of this concern with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 62. And eventually it did get banned. So a lot of people, including myself, had no idea that the largest DDT manufacturer was right here in Los Angeles. And, you know, this company got rid of its waste, which contained DDT in a number of ways. You know, as I was going through the archives on what coverage we had on this issue, you know, one way that they disposed of their waste was through the sewage, which ultimately dumped out into the ocean off the Palos Verdes coast. That became the center of an epic Superfund battle in the 90s and early 2000s, which was very well documented through the archives. But what many folks didn't know at the time was that this company also got rid of its waste by taking barrels of the stuff out near Catalina and dumping them directly into the ocean. I found reports that said the crews would even puncture the barrels with like an axe, so the barrels would actually sink to the bottom. So, you know, we focus on the waste dumping through the sewage, and now the Palos Verdes shore is like the largest underwater Superfund site in the country. But David Valentine, a researcher at UC Santa Barbara, had heard rumors about this barrel dumping. And a few years ago, he had this super amazing deep sea robot on loan for a different research mission, but that project was ahead of schedule. So he had a little extra time to poke around in the water. And when he dropped the robot 3,000 feet underwater, he came across these barrels, and it really was a oh my God moment. And so he called me, and I saw images of these barrels underwater. And, you know, we both had all these questions. What are these barrels? How did they get there? How many are there? And that's what I really tried to answer in my story.
I mean, it is such an incredible story. I mean, we'll go into detail, but you spoke with scientists who have been trying to ring the alarm bells for decades, and they felt like no one was listening. The government wasn't listening. The EPA wasn't listening. And one scientist you interviewed, and we'll talk more in depth about this after a break, but she said, you've got to get the public to really raise alarm bells about this in order for something to finally happen. And a lot of these scientists were so glad that you were revisiting this issue.
Right. And, you know, it was such an interesting exercise in reporting to figure out, you know, if were these barrels a unknown history of chapter of this history, or was it a forgotten chapter of this history? And part of just trying to figure out the, like, what are these barrels and how many are there, was just figuring out which scientists were there, scientists that had been studying them. And it was just this kind of piecemeal step-by-step approach of finding all of the scientists back in the day who had dedicated their careers to studying this. And there were a number of them. And I think the overall theme was that the barrel dumping 3,000 feet underwater is very deep. You know, it was so hard to prove at the time and just got relatively little attention. And I do think that the deep ocean is just such an abstract concept at times that it's really hard to rally the public behind in support of this. And I mean, this was the 80s and 90s. I feel like we're in a very different era now, and 2020 quite literally does give us some hindsight. So it was just a really powerful exercise in reporting as I found these scientists who, you know, had these studies that were in paper form. A lot of their studies hadn't even been digitized. And just to be able to piece the story together and to realize that so many of the questions that they had back then are still the questions that we have today was just such a powerful story of like then and now and what this means for our future.
Right. And it's amazing that it's taken so long. We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking today with Los Angeles Times reporter Rosanna Shaw, who published an investigative piece, really incredible piece, about how the waters off of Catalina Island became a dumping ground for DDT waste from the 40s to the 80s. As many as 500,000 barrels had been dumped just off the coast of Los Angeles. And I hope you can take the time to read her pieces at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Rosanna Shaw, an environment reporter for the Los Angeles Times, about her investigation. LA's coast was once a DDT dumping ground. No one could see it until now. And you could read this piece at yourcallradio.org. I'm really glad, Rosanna, that you began by talking about DDT, because that was one of our questions, is what is it? And you report that it was once, as you said, hailed as a major scientific achievement. DDT combated both malaria and typhus during World War II. It was so potent that a single application could protect a soldier for months. You report that the U.S. Army Chief of Preventive Medicine, Brigadier General James Simmons, famously praised the chemical as, quote, the war's greatest contribution to the future health of the world. And as you report, manufacturers rushed to supply the post-war demand, including this company. Is it Montrose Chemical Corporation? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Montrose.
Montrose. And so it opened its plant near Torrance in 1947. So tell us more about that, how the industry was celebrated at the time.
Yeah, I think there was this rush post-World War II to bring these chemicals to the farming industry and just a bunch of other uses. I think DDT was so effective in combating malaria and typhus, and this was something that was used internationally. And Montrose was the largest DDT maker in our country. And it was just, I think the chemical industry at that time was just celebrated, like science, it was science, it was magic. It was something that was just really effective in combating some of these problems that were both annoying, like bugs on a beach, or really important to agriculture, and it really helped boost our economy. I found photos, you know, through my historical research from the 1950s, where we would just spray DDT everywhere, on farms, along streets, even on beaches. But then in 1962, Rachel Carson, in her book Silent Spring, really explained in such a simple, powerful way how chemicals like DDT can poison and ripple across an entire ecosystem. DDT in particular is so stable that it doesn't break down. It can take generations to break down. So basically what it does is just, it continues to accumulate and magnify up the food chain. And Silent Spring was really revolutionary. The public outcry in the 60s was so loud, and ultimately Congress banned the use of DDT in 1972. I hadn't read Silent Spring in decades, and it's still a really powerful book. It was very eerie to read Rachel Carson's words from the 60s and think about kind of the environmental issues that we're still grappling with today.
The photos are incredible, so I hope listeners can take the time to look at those photos that you mentioned that are in your piece. You also write that a top U.S. Department of Agriculture scientist urged the military not to allow DDT for commercial use without future research. So you have quotes from other scientists say that we don't fully understand how this chemical interacts with the living world. And as you write, decades of painstaking studies still lay ahead for biologists. This was a scientist who won a Nobel Prize back in 1948, Paul Hermann Muller.
Right. That was the scientist who won an award for the discovery of how to use DDT as an effective insecticide. And a lot of these questions we're still trying to figure out. We're still in many ways living out the long-term impacts of having something as stable as DDT, even in tiny doses, accumulating in dolphins and sea lions and our own bodies for so long. You know, studies so far show that DDT does have some kind of impact to our immune systems and our hormone systems. And what's really unique about DDT, you know, I just talked about how it can take generations to break down. In a scary way, it also is something that mothers can pass on to their children. So that is how DDT continues to be this persistent chemical in our environment, in our bodies, in our ecosystems. You know, there's that term forever chemical that's now being used for a new generation of chemicals that we're grappling with kind of in the environmental pollution space. But with DDT, it does, you know, accumulate further up the food chain you go. By the time you get to top predators like sea lions, there's just so much of it in their blubber from all the contaminated fish they've eaten. And, you know, I recently wrote about a study by the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, you know, which looked at hundreds of sea lions in California, and they found that A, significant amounts of DDT are still accumulating in their blubber. You know, remember, DDT was banned for like decades ago, 70s, 80s. And B, you know, they also found that these chemicals somehow make it more likely for cancer to metastasize in the sea lion's body, you know, once they got the cancer. And sea lions are such an interesting indicator species for humans because their environment truly is our environment. They swim in the same shallow waters we swim in, surf in. They eat a lot of the same seafood that we eat. They come onto land and breathe the same air we breathe, unlike dolphins or whales, which are like deeper sea animals. So it's been really interesting to see how much of the science is still trying to connect these dots, because with something like DDT, it takes generations for you to kind of really see the long, long-term impacts of having a persistent chemical like this remain in the environment for so long.
And it speaks to what you wrote. The ocean covers more than 70% of the planet, but it can only absorb so much. What we eat, what we breathe is ultimately dictated by what we do to the sea.
Right. And I remember this interview with one scientist down at Scripps at UC San Diego. And, you know, he was kind of reflecting. He teaches silent spring and DDT as like a chapter of history of how the world used to be. And he told me, you know, I wonder sometimes whether or not our future generations of scientists, they will be, you know, really grappling and focusing their careers on fixing these problems of the past. And just this like idea that we have for so long thought of the ocean as just this unlimited garbage dump, right? Not just for DDT, but for plastics, for, you know, all the unwanted like runoff. And like, it's just one of these things, like at what point is the ocean too big to fail? I keep seeing that in the news today. The ocean is too big to fail. And now it's like, you know, about to, what is the breaking point? And that is a very interesting question that, you know, we are still trying to answer. And I do see a greater collective conscience today on how much we rely on.
Oh, Rosanna, are you still with us?
Oh, I might have accidentally muted.
Oh, okay.
The ocean is too big to fail, but at what point is the breaking point?
Yeah, no, it's such an important question. Today, we're joined by Rosanna Shaw, an environment reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She covers the coast and has written about sea level rise, toxic dumping, and endangered species in the deep ocean. And she wrote an investigative piece in October about how the waters off Catalina Island became a dumping ground for DDT waste from the 40s to the 80s. And you can join us if you have any questions for Rosanna about her piece and what she found at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for a very good program as usual. Two things come to mind. Not long ago, off the Bay Bridge, we dumped some material. I'm not so sure that it was DDT. But it was some material considered toxic. It was dumped in tanks right outside of the Bay Bridge. Perhaps somebody has memory of what was done. That caused an uproar. I think this thing was stopped, but the material is still offshore in the sea. And when it comes to DDT, I'm originally from Haiti. I believe DDT was used to fight a problem with mosquitoes, okay? Mm. And it was huge on a fairly large scale, and I think there's been some poisoning that resulted from that. I wonder if anybody remembers the use of DDT to fight the presence of mosquitoes in some countries. I'll stop here. I don't have anything more specific about that. But I thought I would raise these two issues. And thank you very much for the program.
Thank you so much, Max.
Yeah, Max, thank you. And you have a great memory. So I'll just point to first. Yes, DDT was the main chemical that really helped eradicate malaria. It was what used for eradication, malaria eradication programs by the World Health Organization and just numerous countries. And that was part of the talking points in terms of during the 60s when we were grappling in the US about whether or not to ban DDT. Not only was DDT effective in boosting our agricultural industries, it was very effective at eradicating malaria, which has been a very critical health issue in especially like in other international countries. As for dumping in San Francisco Bay, I don't know the specific details, but I will say that in my history research and just review of what we did back in the day, I mean, ocean dumping, the ocean was just considered the largest landfill and the most effective landfill for decades. It wasn't regulated until I'm blanking on the year, but the Ocean Dumping Act was passed in like, I think the early 70s or 80s. And with San Francisco, I mean, like we used to dump radioactive waste into the ocean. Rachel Carson had a book before Silent Spring called The Sea Around Us, and it was focused on the way we polluted the ocean. Rachel Carson was a marine scientist. And with the Farallon Islands, I know there was a history of that, the dredge and the sand and all of the pollution buildup in what's actually in the sediment in the bay is also something that should be looked at in more detail. That was not something that I was able to get into, but there were a number of out of print textbooks and science report synthesis from the 60s, 70s, 80s that I found, you know, on eBay as I was like bidding for them to kind of review the history of what we did to the ocean back in the day. That was like the title of the book was on ocean dumping or a synthesis of ocean dumping from the 50s. So this is something that was very commonly done. So I do appreciate, Max, you bringing up this point because I would like to make clear that it wasn't just this one chemical company in Los Angeles dumping DDT off of like one patch of ocean near Catalina. This was a practice that was done everywhere.
Mm. Well, thank you for the questions, Max. Nice to hear from you. Speaking of the company, let's spend some more time talking about this company, Montrose. We have an email from Sam who says, are they still in business? Who owns them now? Can you tell us more about this company?
Yeah, so Montrose operated from the 40s post-World War II until, so DDT was banned in the U.S. The use of DDT was banned in the U.S. in 1972, but, you know, they didn't ban making it. So Montrose still had a very large international market, again, to eradicate malaria for agriculture. So they operated from 72 for another 10 years, and they shut down in 1982. And Montrose, as a company making DDT, no longer exists, but the Superfund battle that was introduced in the 90s over the way they dumped, how their waste made it through this. They dumped it into the sewage made it into the ocean. And that battle, and just also the plant itself on the border of Torrance in Los Angeles, is still a Superfund site. There is still elements of that Superfund battle happening in court. So Montrose still exists as a entity in court, continuing this legal battle over kind of who's in charge of what cleanup. Because, you know, aside from the ocean portion, there's the plant itself, its impacts on the groundwater, its impact on the surrounding land. All of that is still kind of getting wrapped up in the courts. So Montrose still exists as a company for that purpose.
So can you tell us more about just how this ended up in the ocean and what scientists over time revealed?
So, like I said earlier, there's a lot of DDT that is in the shallower waters off of Palos Verdes due to the way the DDT waste made it through the sewage and through the outfall. And that's kind of spread out over the 17 square mile area on the shallower coast of Los Angeles. And with the waste that is near Catalina, like that was just boated out in barrels and barges and just dumped straight into the ocean. And that is kind of a new area of pollution and a new area of history that we're still trying to wrap our minds around. The UC Santa Barbara team that first came across these barrels a few years ago with like high tech technology. Again, you know, we were talking earlier about how the scientists from the 80s like couldn't even prove that it was really down there because we just didn't have the technology back then to show it. The UC Santa Barbara team was able to use cameras and identify about 60 barrels underwater, 3,000 feet deep near Catalina in just the extra time that they had on a separate research mission. And, you know, based on available information from historic records, shipping logs, other documents we were able to find from back in the day, there could be as many as 500,000 barrels still down there today. And the UC Santa Barbara team was also able to gather a few samples, and those samples indicated that the barrels are perhaps leaking over time, but we actually don't. There's still so many questions that we need to answer. We don't know how many barrels there are down there. We don't know what's actually inside the barrels. We don't know how much of the stuff that's in the barrels is remobilizing up the water column in the food chain. So those are all questions that the scientists, the science community right now are trying to wrap their minds around.
Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Carol in San Francisco. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I tuned in late, so maybe you already discussed this, but have you talked about the radioactive materials that were dumped out at the Farallones?
No, we've not talked about that. Are you familiar with that?
Well, sorry, I know in the 1970s it was making news because they were trying to figure out what to do with it. I don't have the details on the top of my head, but I know that it was an issue then. And I don't think they removed the cans.
Rosanna, are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I mentioned this in my response to Max, but that I did come across mentions of that, but that was not kind of within the scope of my research on this specific issue. So I don't actually know the specific details of it. But like, absolutely, again, we weren't just dumping chemicals related to DDT production in Los Angeles. And this wasn't just an isolated thing. Like, you know, Rachel Carson wrote an entire book on the way we were dumping radioactive waste into the ocean, and the Farallones and, you know, the Bay Area is not, you know, separate from that. This was just a ocean dumping of chemicals, waste, oil refinery waste, radioactive waste. All of that was a very kind of normal practice in the 40s and 50s.
Well, thank you for the call, Carol. Can we talk about why it has taken so long to take action on this? You write about Alan Chartrand, a scientist at the California Regional Water Quality Board in Los Angeles, who said he heard whispers that Montrose dumped barrels of toxic waste directly in the ocean in the early 80s. And he and his team pulled out a number of files, and they went through volumes of shipping logs, which showed that more than 2,000 barrels of DDT-laced sludge were dumped every month. They did the math, and they found that between 1947 and 1961, as much as 767 tons of DDT could have gone into the ocean. What happened after this information was made public?
Right. So that was kind of a really helpful turning point for me in the reporting process, because there is, you know, again, you know, like I said earlier, the first question that I went into this was this a forgotten chapter of history or a unknown chapter of history? And it turns out that there were, you know, a small group of scientists who were actively looking into this issue, and it just never got the same traction and public attention as the Superfund site and the sewage dumping did. And with the Alan Chartrand report from 1985, that's where we're getting kind of the estimates of like, there could be as many as 500,000 barrels in the ocean right now, because he actually found shipping logs and documented kind of and calculated and made estimations based on the available data and reports at the time. And his report, you know, did create and start this kind of scientific query that, you know, you mentioned the UCLA professor from the 80s. And again, this was just so hard to prove at the time, and rallying for the deep ocean was just like such an abstract concept at the time. And, you know, I can't really answer specifically why this report and this issue just didn't take off. But, you know, there was just the paper record just went cold at one point. And it wasn't until Dave Valentine at UC Santa Barbara found, you know, was able to provide visual images of this pollution underwater that this conversation has, you know, restarted. And I think the other thing that, you know, has really come clear to me as I'm doing, as I was doing this reporting, is just, you know, I ask every scientist that I talk to, like, what are the solutions? And I think it's really hard to wrestle with pollution that is 3,000 feet deep. Like, that is so deep that, like, you know, your gut instinct when you see a photo of these barrels might be like, let's take them out. I don't think I've talked to a single scientist who thinks that's the right way to go, because if you think about the pressure difference, bringing up a corroded, punctured barrel from 3,000 feet underwater up to the surface, like, that's just like a that's just not a good idea, right? And I, you know, are there ways we could be capping them more thoughtfully? Like, what do we do is a really tough question when it's so deep underwater. And I think also just this lesson that when you put something like DDT out into the environment, when you're spraying it, when you're dumping into the ocean, and it's just kind of in the air that we breathe and the waters that we swim in, and you know, accumulating up the food chain, it's really hard to take back a pollution like that. So I think this history lesson of DDT dumping has also informed and kind of prompted this new renewed discussion today on, like, what chemicals like DDT are we putting out into the environment today with not as much knowledge and regulation that, like, 50 years from now, someone else will be doing a report saying, look at all the stuff that we put into the environment 50 years ago that now we can't take back.
We're almost out of time, but can you also tell us a little bit about what happened in 1990 after Alan Chartand, the scientist we were just talking about, compiled his reports? The EPA teamed up with the state and launched a court battle against Montrose, this company, and a number of others under the Superfund law. You write that environmental groups expected the lawsuit, the largest in U.S. history, alleging natural resource damages from chemical dumping, to be a landmark case in resolving coastal pollution issues. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened there?
Right. That's the Superfund battle that I've been talking about. So there's two tracks, the deep sea dumping off of Catalina and then the sewage dumping off of Palos Verdes. The Chartrand's report was in 1985. And I think there was also kind of in parallel, Alan Chartrand was reporting as a regulatory scientist for the California Regional Water Quality Control Board that this deep sea dumping was happening. There was also a lot of just new documentation and reports of how the company was dumping its waste into the sewage system and how that just, there was more documentation of how that was making it out into the ocean through the sewage outfall. So the Superfund site was introduced in the 90s to just address the legacy pollution by this company, which again had shut down in 1982. So that Superfund battle result is still going. The ocean portion was concluded in a partial consent decree in the early 2000s. I'm blanking on the exact date. And that, you know, that is a way of addressing, it was $140 million in total that was settled. And that $140 million has been dedicated to figuring out what to do with the Palos Verdes underwater Superfund site, which is not related to the deep ocean dumping in the barrels. And also the $140 million was dedicated towards, you know, restoring the bald eagles, which had, that population had been pretty knocked out in our area, in our region, and also, you know, fish habitats, and just, and also educating the public on just what it means to be fishing for contaminated fish off of piers, because there was just this whole education component that needed to happen. It's back. I mean, we think of food chains and today and understanding kind of ecosystem interconnections, like, that's pretty common, I would say, knowledge today, but that was something that really had to be taught to previous generations, you know, starting with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring.
Right. You also report that you contacted the attorneys representing Montrose, but they declined to comment on the new underwater data.
Right.
So what response did you get to this investigation? What happened after this came out in October?
Yeah, it has been really cool to see so many corners of science and government come together on this issue since the report came out. You know, my phone and inbox exploded after the story ran, and I know the lead scientist from UC Santa Barbara also got flooded with emails from people wanting to know, like, what can we do? You know, and I, you know, as we discussed, there are, like, so many questions that we need to answer before we even get to the part of, like, remediation and what it means to actually mitigate the solution, if it's even possible. But, you know, one of the, you know, next step questions that everyone in the science world seems to agree on is we need to get a better sense of the actual scope of the problem. We need to map the seafloor. And that was pretty hard to do back in the day with the limited technology that we had. But today we do have access to all of this other, all this higher tech image, higher tech robots and imagery, you know, technology. And it would be really helpful to map the seafloor and get a sense of like where these barrels might be, how many there are, whether there are any hotspots, you know, and then from there we can start figuring out where to target our chemical analyses and sediment samples and all of that. So with this question in mind, a team of scientists at Scripps down at UC San Diego saw this issue and was like, hey, we have this really amazing partnership with NOAA where we have access to all these, you know, high-tech underwater robots, like really just ahead of the curve technology. And Scripps happened to have access to a few new robots that they had been meaning to test run. And so rather than doing a more scripted test off of, you know, San Diego, they decided to use these robots to answer that first big question. And they just went out to sea for 2 weeks to map almost 50,000 acres of seafloor at 3,000 feet deep with sonar. It's incredible. And an expedition like this big, usually takes at least 2 or 3 years to come together. But because of kind of the momentum and heightened public interest, this expedition came together, you know, in 5 months. And it's just, they just came back, I think, from port.
Oh, that's incredible. And are you planning to write about that, about their findings?
Oh, yeah. I'm super excited to see what the data shows. Another amazing part to all of this is like NOAA and Scripps said that they're planning to make this data, you know, available as quickly as possible. And, you know, within 30 days of them coming back from sea, they said they were going to polish the data set and post it permanently online so that other scientists and, you know, regulatory agencies and government officials could really start thinking about what next steps to take, you know, and I hopefully will be writing more about this soon as well.
Well, Rosanna, thank you so much for another incredible investigation, and we'd love to have you back once you write about their findings. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rosanna Shaw is an environment reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She published an investigative piece about how the waters off Catalina Island became a dumping ground for DDT waste from the 40s to the 80s. As many as 500,000 barrels had been dumped just off the coast of Los Angeles. And you can find the piece at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
Tune into Cross Currents today at 5. We'll hear about the unlikely couple that inspired hope and community during the pandemic.
In the deepest throes of quarantine woes, if you will, like they were sort of my beacon of light for a bit.
The Lake Merritt Duck Couple, today at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News.